stand by for action.
Gamer's Haven Special Edition.
This is Ethan with the Gamer's Haven Podcast with yet another interview. This time it's a joint interview with Jeff Greiner over at The Tome Show at www.thetomeshow.com. Also a part of the Vorpal Network. Jeff was kind enough to get me in touch with Mr. Ed Greenwood, who, as you will find out, had a lot to say. So I want to thank Jeff Greiner over at The Tome Show and encourage everybody to go over to thetomeshow.com. It's a great D&D podcast, and also a member of the Vorpal Network at vorpalnetwork.com. So all that aside, please enjoy the interview. Noble Knight Games has been serving the needs of thousands of gamers worldwide since 1997. With a huge selection of over 30,000 unique products, including discounts on most in-print games of up to 50% off or more. Noble Knight Games is the place for out-of-print RPGs, board games, war games, collectible card games, miniatures, and all things game-related. They ship worldwide and will purchase or trade your titles you no longer need, new, or used. Your satisfaction is guaranteed. Just visit www.noblenight.com or visit our website for direct access to thousands of new, out-of-print, and in some cases, one-of-a-kind items. And this is Ethan with the Gamers Haven Podcast, and I am here with one of my good colleagues, Jeff Greiner, from The Tome Show. Say hi, Jeff.
Hello, Jeff.
And Jeff was kind enough to facilitate me into getting in touch with Mr. Ed Greenwood, who really needs no introduction. Say hi, Ed.
Hi, Ed. Oh, a horse is a horse, of course, of course. Now, how many copyright laws have we broken so far?
Oh, well, I think we're covered under fair use.
Cool.
Yes, I don't think they're gonna. I don't think we're gonna impede on their income in any way. So we'll be fine. But this is Ed Greenwood, and as everyone, as our faithful listeners should know, Ed Greenwood is, of course, the creator of the Forgotten Realms for Dungeons & Dragons. Now, of course, it wasn't originally for Dungeons & Dragons, if I have read correctly. Is that right?
Sorry?
I'm sorry. Forgotten Realms, was it originally...
Oh, yeah, Forgotten Realms precedes the Dungeons & Dragons game by, I don't know. Gary first had the game 74, and most of us didn't see it until 75, and I was writing Forgotten Realms stuff in 1966, and I didn't have the name until 1967. So, yeah, it precedes the game that we all know and love.
Excellent, excellent.
It was originally fantasy world.
Go ahead.
So it was really just originally just a fantasy world for my short stories. I wanted to write a series of short stories about a fat, wheezing merchant called Mert, the moneylender, who used to be Conan, but he's way too old and fat to be Conan anymore. And so he's one of those crooked, swindling merchants, the snake oil / used car salesman of his day. Which means he has to keep moving along the Sword Coast just ahead of his creditors. And because he kept moving along the Sword Coast, I kept building a world around him.
Excellent. I sort of ask all of all the people I've been interviewing, how did you get into the gaming hobby in general?
Ooh. The gaming hobby in general? You mean as a player or as in writing for it?
As a player first, and then writing for it.
Well, as a player, I grew up playing all sorts of board games and all the classic games like Parcheesi and so on, and all the card games. My grandparents, who were of the sort who used to deal out the cards for euchre face down, and then everybody would turn the face up and said, "You would have won that, you would have won that," and then they just gather the cards and reshuffle. Incredibly exciting for, you know, a six-year-old. And then my father was a radar physicist for NATO, and he had some games around the house, simulation games, and then games like Diplomacy, the original pre-Avalon Hill, beautiful wooden pieces, gorgeous map board, and I grew up playing those. And so any game that was halfway interesting that came along, there was an old Milton Bradley game called Pirate and Traveler, where you travel around the world moving real cargoes from this real port to that real port until you got a certain number of points. Then you turned into a pirate and tried to stop all the other players getting their points. But, you know, all sorts of games like that. That's how I started as a player. I've always been interested in games, not so much about winning, but about having a good time sitting around the table with friends. And as a gamer, it started really with finding some obvious holes in the rules of a board game from TS called Divine Right. And by obvious holes, I mean one of the rules ended in mid-sentence. And the rule book had a different number of armies for a kingdom called Shukasim from the counter punch-out sheet. So you had to decide, do we go with the number of armies on the punch-out sheet, or do we go by the rule book? So I wrote an article for that, for Dragon. It wasn't the first thing that came out, because they held on to it for a theme Divine Right issue. And I was playing D&D by then, and they said, "Hey, anything we print in the Dragon's Bestiary, formerly featured creature, becomes an official monster, as official as anything in the Monster Manual, and you get paid $25. Great. Of course, in those days, the U.S. dollar was worth about twice the Canadian dollar, and I'm Canadian, so hey, that was $50. So I started writing in monsters and sending them off. And the first monster I sent off, they sent me back a nice little card saying they loved it. And the second monster I sent off, 16 days later, my issue of Dragon came to me in the mail with a monster in it. I said, "Oh, they're desperate. They have no monsters at all. There's no way they'd use mine that quickly." So I started typing up monsters as fast as I could.
Cool.
And that's how I broke into
Awesome. So you started off by designing monsters. Were you designing monsters like mechanically, or were you designing monsters in terms of you know, their appearance and their, you know, sort of the bestiary sort of?
Oh, everything.
So you did all of it. And this was in first edition?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. You did everything. You illustrated the monster. And in fact, some of my illustrations, the early ones in Dragon Magazine, looked like I did them with crayon. I actually did them with a Staedtler fine art pen to be really tiny, nice of a postage stamp.
Wow.
So I could fit more text in.
Oh,
and then
sure.
They reset my text and then blew up the picture to be big, and it looked horrible. But anyway, no, you had to design it. You had to make it fit with the ecology of all the other monsters in the Monster Manual,
mm-hmm.
which either meant it had to fill a vacant niche in sort of the food chain, or be so sufficiently different from everything else that it could be an oddity, okay? Or it had to mimic another monster. And one of the problems of early first edition D&D, all the players and all the DMs read the same stuff. And it was basically the official rule books and Dragon. So if you saw something with a spherical body, one big eye, and a whole bunch of eye stalks, it was either a beholder or a gaspar. Nothing else, mm-hmm. according to the official rules. Which meant, if you wanted to make your players role play, as opposed to memorize the rule books, every group of players has at least one rules lawyer who would say, "Oh, right. That spell goes this many rounds and does this damage, so do this to it, and we'll know how powerful a monster is." You know, and you go, "Oh, thanks." You know, because there goes your atmosphere that you've built up by your great narration as the Dungeon Master.
Mm-hmm.
All that's out the window, because you've got this guy sitting across the table who's dragging you back to this level, and I memorized it, and it's on this page of the rulebook. So, of course, to kick people like that out of that groove and back into role-playing, you started writing look-alike monsters, and I did a whole bunch of beholder look-alikes, just to pick one example. The Death Kiss, Undead Beholders, all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The Undead Beholders are called the Death Tyrant and so on. The Gaunt. I just came up with tons of them and threw them at people so that once they were in Dragon, they were official. So mm-hmm. I wasn't a cheater killer DM. I was just a Dungeon Master throwing something at them that they couldn't use, because they couldn't tell. Even if they read the issue of Dragon, they didn't know which of the fake monsters I was using.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, I did it. In those days, you had to do everything. You had to do the rules for the monster. By all means, Tim Kask, who was editor of Dragon then, and Jake, who was his assistant editor and then took over as editor, and then Kim Mohan came on as assistant editor. And so they would, by all means, take the stats to one of the designers to tinker with if they thought you were way off. But yeah, you wrote the whole monster up, and the whole idea of getting published was to do all the work so they didn't have to. They could open it, read it, say, hey, this is cool, put it in the issue. And then you got, you know, your monster in right away. You know, you didn't want to do something that was half designed and make them say, well, you know, when we've got a day to fix it, or kick it back at them, it's no good. I wanted to see my monsters right away so I could use them as a DM. So yeah, you did everything. I think I did 60 or 70 monsters for the D&D game, and most of them have made it up through all the editions, although 4th edition, there haven't been enough of rule books yet to get all the monsters in.
Sure.
So, you know, they'll come.
Yeah. Now, in your more modern career, you seem to mostly, in terms of Dungeons & Dragons, you seem to mostly work on story elements or fluff or however you want to call it. You don't see a lot of mechanics by Ed Greenwood. When did that shift sort of happen?
It started to happen with Wizards of the Coast, because Wizards of the Coast was increasingly and particularly after they became a subsidiary of Hasbro, an intellectual property company. And what that means is they didn't want a whole lot of stuff out there in the hands of people who weren't employees that was core rule stuff before it was published. Because, you know, the mindset of a large creative company is to protect their intellectual property. So more and more, if it was a rules-heavy thing, it was either a freelance assignment, like, hey, Ed, do this for us. Okay, and then send it back in. Or, what would you handle about this place? And I off the top of my head, I told them the stories to make some facts. And then somebody in-house on staff would do the mechanics, because they didn't want me to have access to the mechanics. Now, back in the TSR era, that secrecy was sometimes enforced, too. In fact, they're sometimes comically so. Mm-hmm. On one occasion, on one of the editions of Forgotten Realms, I got a surprise phone call at work from TSR's lawyer saying, I've been ordered to send you a copy of this Forgotten Realms thing. But before I can do that, I need to know, what is actually your interest in seeing it? What connection do you have with Forgotten Realms? I said, well, I created it. And immediately, oh, no, you didn't. And I must caution you as a lawyer not to make statements like that. You could be in very serious trouble if we decide to take action. And it was like, oh, my God. Okay, you're a non-gamer, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's when the mechanics dropped off. And the other thing is, as you get older, you get less and less receptive to new things. It's like settling on a programming language for computers. If somebody comes up with one that improves upon the one you're used to, you change to it. But after about 8 changes, you start going, oh, God, can we just stay with the same one? You know. And it, for me and my players, it was the same way with Dungeon Master. I just want to stay with what we're comfortable with. In my home campaign, we vote on everything. the players and the DM have a vote. So if they don't want to change something, they don't change something. They moved from first to second edition, probably mainly because two of the players wanted to play the second edition Bard, which sounded cooler than the first edition Bard. And because the guarantee from first to second edition of D&D is you could use them side by side. Mm-hmm. You know, you could combine elements of both without too much flexing.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't voted to move on. So third edition, although I bought all the rule books as a design thing, I had to, and then 3.5 and now 4. But you see, by now, the system is so divorced from what I was used to writing and designing in that I have to think about everything. And first edition and second edition were both like language to me. I could just, you say, okay, design a monster that's sort of mid-level that could be a good guardian of a door or gateway. It should have some sort of limited telekinesis ability, or some sort of really limited shape-changing ability, but not much. And I need it to be a challenge to a party about this size. I say, okay, a backward outcome, everything in perfect second edition rules format, ready to be put into print. I could just think in that design system. I'm not saying it wasn't riddled with flaws. Every edition of the game has had its own flaws, and they continue to do so.
Mm-hmm.
The third edition was a change in focus for the game, a change in the way of doing things. There were different things in the design philosophy. For instance, in Forgotten Realms, it was understood that you as player characters were small cogs in the world. You mm-hmm. could be big wheels, but there would always be somebody more powerful. You always had to know mm-hmm. that no matter how high and mighty you got, there would be a time it might be a good idea to run away from the monster. But in third edition, the design philosophy was, no, you can become everything any god or huge monster can be. You can beat everything. So it's a different design. It's not necessarily better or worse. It's just different. So you have to do it differently. And fourth edition is a different direction yet again from third edition. As it happens, I love to collect miniatures. I don't love to use them in my games. Just because every time my group tried to play with miniatures, which we were encouraged to do in play tests for a Vault of the Drow, way back, the Demon of the Pit series, when it mm-hmm. first came out, because you had these irregular caverns with stalactites and stalagmites, and you'd be going along, and you'd either ambush a Drow caravan, or a Drow patrol would ambush you. And for that, you really did need figures, because lines of fire, can my fireball get through that row of stalactites that I'm firing along like a row of pillars, but I'm trying to get it diagonally through it, you know, all that stuff. But what we discovered is it pulled us out of the role-playing and thinking and picturing the situation in our heads, and it pulled us back into playing a game and looking down at little figures, and it took forever. And by then, most of my players were, quote, growing up. I say that, but we all had jobs, you know, okay? So playtime together was precious to us. So we were less and less enthused at spending 3 hours on a battle. But we didn't want to fight. We had more time, more fun role-playing. The old, you pull your sword half out of its scabbard and say, I would hate it if you did that, Majesty, because you might make me actually draw this thing. Why don't you reconsider, and me and my friends can all put our swords away? You know, they had more fun doing that sort of stuff than actually fighting. So we didn't want to use miniatures. Now, well, what have you seen in the later parts of the game? Third edition and fourth edition, miniatures become an integral part of playing the game.
Mm-hmm.
I love doing it when I go to, say, Dean, here, all the tiles laid out, and this is really cool. And I think to myself, can't we all just empty our pockets and use pennies? You know? Can we save some money here? And can we just draw it on graph paper? Because, you know, we might need this money for something else. There's a huge exhibit hall full of stuff I want to buy over there. And you know, it just, for me, it didn't work as well. So I don't think in terms of either third edition or fourth edition mechanics. Mm-hmm. And the way things work these days, it's easier for all of us, both me and the various publishers, if they either tell me, oh, Ed, we'll do the mechanics in-house, just give us this,
mm-hmm.
or I do it with the mechanics, and they say, don't worry about the mechanics, we know what you were trying to achieve, we'll fix it, which is fine with me. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, when Paizo wants me to do Pathfinder stuff, I would be far more comfortable, even though I've got the rulebook and I've read through it, and I'm admiring it as a designer, it's not sticking in my head as something I start thinking in that game system. Because I've worked on too many different games, and I've worked on too many different rule systems, and I'm too busy writing novels and short stories for my brain to say, okay, now how do we handle that in this edition of the game? I just stop and say, who cares? I'm a dungeon master. It's a story. We set up this situation, and then I don't care what the rules are because my players don't care what the rules are, and it's about letting my players do what they want. So my role as DM reverts to being the role of a good talk show host when you've got about four guests on at once. You sort of sit there across the table and say, what would you do, guest A? Okay, and what are you doing this round, guest B? Oh, and guest C, your fireball, is it ready? Guest D. Okay, well, you guys discuss amongst yourselves what you're going to do with the dragon. By the way, the dragon can hear you, but he's 10 feet away. You know, in other words, I'm leaving it up to my players. I don't want to force the players through an adventure. I want the players to choose the adventure. Even if I'm actually going to force them through an adventure, I don't want them to feel that way. I don't want them to feel that there's a stick right behind them and I'm got a very short string in front of them. I want them to feel like, hey, they've got the whole world to explore. That's why I spent all of these years, you know, creating this Forgotten Realms. You can go anywhere. I've got it all detailed. You pick your adventure. And when you do it that way, and it's all roleplay, the rules really don't matter. The rules only matter if there's going to be a dispute around the gaming table or if you're playing with people not in your normal group. Say, for instance, at a tournament, at a convention, then, yeah, we all have to know what rules are going to apply. Or people get angry, they've been treated unfairly. But if it's the same group of people, the rules stop mattering after a while. Everybody has their own house rules, and they settle on to what they want to do anyway, and, you know, who cares? Now, that's completely different from the needs of a gaming company, which is trying to sell you stuff. And inevitably, there is rule stuff in what they're trying to sell you, unless it's a straight novel or book of short stories. And these days, I actually do more novels and books of short stories because, hey, I like to eat.
Now, you mentioned some of the changes in focus in the game over time, and you mentioned at least that changed the perspective of how the game interacts with the Forgotten Realms in 3rd edition. How does that change again in the Forgotten Realms for 4th edition? You know, because the focus on 4th edition is very different from 3rd.
Well, okay. One of the problems for any publisher is how do you present a fantasy setting? Do you lay out everything in detailed lore, or do you let people wing it? And one of the things that the Bell Plague, which is the cataclysmic event that moved the Forgotten Realms from the end of 3.5 edition, which is sort of the 1370s DR, and then the Blue Fire starts, and we jump almost a century in real time to the Year of the Ageless One, and it's 4th edition realms. Everything has changed. And what that means is, in earlier editions, particularly 2nd editions, we had chance to develop and develop geographical areas than I could cover it in the 1st edition books. It was all heavy lore, backstory, histories. In fact, if you look at some of the box sets, remember box sets? You know, we had timelines, long timelines in all of the products. Some people love that stuff. Some people hate it, you know. And the other thing is, gaming and publishing, book publishing, I mean, you know, fiction book publishing, are different in some ways. Gamers would usually like you, the publisher, to keep everything in print. You know, so if they want to pick up this thing that some guy told them had a really cool rule in it that was published 30 years ago, where is it? Why did you let that go out of print? Now, I realize things have changed in the electronic age, but I mean, the problem was there first, before the internet and so on, before PDFs, before downloads. The problem was the company had grown big enough, it can't sell directly into everybody it wants to reach by itself. It has to use a distributor, like, for instance, Random House, which was one of the distributors for TSR for the long time, Wizards of the Coast.
Mm-hmm.
And distributors hate filling their warehouses with huge lists of products that may only move a few copies a year. They'd really like you to have the new thing running through and then maybe half a dozen things as for it and everything else out of print again, you know? And that makes it really hard to keep your lore or a setting like the Forgotten Realms in print. And it's an awful lot easier to design or write products, and by products, I don't just mean game stuff, I mean novels, if you can basically wing it. And if you want to have a brand new kingdom that rises up out of ways, that's got eight brothers and eight sisters, princes and princesses, and by tradition they all have to marry each other, but they all hate each other's guts, this could be an interesting story, but it's not the realms unless you sort of say all that stuff you remember from before, well, anything could be different because 100 years have passed and an awful lot of things changed. There were lands were ripped off the face of the realms and other lands are in their place and things are different now. Floating islands in there. Okay, so that way it allows everybody more freedom. It also means that the focus of presenting things inevitably changes. We are back to what's new, what's unfolding in front of you right now. Mm-hmm. Right, I've recently been helping to edit a series of novels called, you know, I hate this title, it sounds so arrogant, but Greenwood Presents Waterdeep. These are one-shot books, and only the first one, Blackstaff Tower by Stephen Shen, which was a sequel to his earlier novel, Blackstaff, which was in the Wizards series of four novels, mm-hmm. just standalone. Every other book in the Ed Greenwood Presents Waterdeep is by a different author. It's a one-shot book, and it gives us a glimpse of another part of Waterdeep in the, quote, new Waterdeep, the Waterdeep of the fourth edition era, starting in the Year of Ages one. But, you know, some of us are looking at nobles, some of us are looking in new neighborhoods, either underground or out in the harbor where all the rotting ships are lashed together, or, you know, things are, you know, we're looking at the same city at roughly the same time from a whole bunch of different mm-hmm. viewpoints. And that
well, what's it
changes
like,
the focus of...
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I just got a quick question.
Changes the focus.
What's it like for to have other authors come in and sort of play in your sandbox, as it were? This is a setting you've cultivated since, you know, you said 1966. What's that like?
Well, it's like this. Right back at the beginning, at the beginning of my agreeing to sell the realms to the company as a game setting, which was really sort of in the 1986 era. I wrote for Dragon from 1979 to 1986 before TSR wanted to buy the realms to be the setting for the second edition of the game. Right back then, I realized, okay, I cannot get sort of creator envy. I can't get angry at people who do things I wouldn't have done, okay? Because the moment it stops being my world, it's our world, I have to accept that people will do things differently. And in fact, that is the great benefit, because as long as I was the creator, my world could never surprise me. I knew if I went around a corner in the road, there was nothing there until I wrote something and put it there. And because I was the only writer, the one thing I couldn't be is surprised. Mm-hmm. And I could make the world seem real to others, but I was the great and terrible Oz behind the curtain, you know, pulling all those levers. I was running around trying to make it look real from the other side. I knew it wasn't real. You know, yes, we all knew it wasn't real, but I mean, that was brought home to me every moment as I rushed around trying to paper over the cracks. And of course, inevitably, as people went in different directions, I couldn't keep up creatively. I could when it was my players. I couldn't once it was a public.
Right.
And the other thing is, The only sort of proviso at the was that we would try and remain consistent. And the traffic cop for the Forgotten Realms at the beginning was Jeff Grubb, a good friend of mine, one of TSR's great game designers. He's still a great game designer, toiling mainly in the worlds of computers these days. And Jeff said, "Don't blow up the moon." And we were basically following the sort of Marvel Comics gentleman's agreement. And, okay, I'm not trying to be gender nasty to the ladies here. The phrase gentleman's agreement was old before we came along. What it meant was you can borrow somebody else's toy with their permission, and it has to be with their permission because you can't have Doctor Strange doing different things in three different comic books in the same month. So for the same reason, at TSR, you had to make sure it was okay with the traffic cop, that was Jeff, for you to use Man or Larlock or pick your character that month. So you wouldn't be messing something up that you didn't know about. For instance, somebody was writing a novel about him, you know, but you were already using him in an adventure and you were going to kill him, which would make it difficult for him to do the things he was then going to do in the novel. So there had to be a sort of, you know, that sort of thing. The gentleman's agreement of you put the toys back in the sandbox as you found them, unless the whole company has agreed to a change. Like, we are going to see King Azun of Cormyr, King Azun the Fourth, die.
Right.
We are moving on from an alive King Azun to a dead King Azun. You know, unless the company makes a decision like that, you were sort of like honor bound not to introduce inconsistencies. And that was the big bugaboo. And it has been since the beginning. People familiar with the realms from its various very early published days will remember that Princess Alucer Nicasia of Cormyr had three different fates at one point. One fate in a novel, one fate in a computer game done by a licensee, and one fate in a adventure module, a gaming module.
Mm-hmm.
So she had three different things that happened to her. She'd gone in three different directions. They were mutually exclusive. So we had to do a lot of quick dancing. And you know, again, the reason why Jeff invoked Marvel Comics, it was did you actually see the body? Well, then he's not dead. If he just plunged over the side of the cliff in the flaming car, he's not dead. You know, we did a lot of fancy explanations. And some great designers, George Crashos, Eric Boyd, the people, particularly Eric, who churned out tons of top-quality products, made careers out of explaining away the inconsistencies that other people would put in. Because the explanations were so cool. It was like, oh, you got to put this in print. Oh, this is great. And that was the whole point of the realms. You had to, every time you tied off a loose end, you had to grow three new ones. If you're going to take away a chance for an adventure from a dungeon master who bought this product and read it, said, oh yeah, I'm going to do something with that. I'm follow up these Zentrum guys as they take over Zentral Keep. If you're actually going to settle something, you have to give them three more new things to go with. So they don't say, oh damn, they just ruined my whole campaign. They can go, oh, well, they ruined that thing, but they gave me these three new cool things.
Well, now that you've got so many people writing in your world now, is there anything out there that you particularly enjoy reading?
I enjoy just about everything. I loved working on the Eddie Presents Waterdeep books because they were such good books. Every one of them grabbed me in a different way. They haven't all been published yet, but there are some of them I will reread again and again with just glee. And I tend to gravitate more towards the fiction these days because there is very little gaming stuff now being published for the realms that is in a conventional format walk in and buy in a hobby shop. It's either on D&D Insider, or it's being played around the tables by the RPGA. And although I sit in on some of the design and consultation things, sort of behind the scenes for that, and I enjoy it, there isn't really as much of an outlet for me to really see the overall picture. I can't see the RPG mm-hmm. overall picture unless I went to all the conventions and played the full arc for an area.
Sure.
And I just don't have time anymore. So it comes down to reading what I can read on the website or the fiction. And for me, sure. most of my time is tied up in the fiction. Now, when I answer gaming stuff, it's usually on Candlekeep, out on the internet, where there's the questions forum and people who want to know particular details of the realms for their campaign pose questions to me, which, you know, is no different from what the designers did at TSR back from 1987 onwards. You know, I was always getting weird questions like, you know, what color the guards' uniforms? Okay, now, I knock a guard out, I tear off his uniform, what color is his underwear? Our artist needs to know, Ed. Okay. So, I mean, I was always answering those questions, and I still am. But for me, it's mainly uh-huh. the fiction these days. I am particularly impressed with some of the new authors that are starting up. And some of them have become well-known. Paul Kemp, Eric Scott, to be, Jaylee Johnson, Aaron Evans, one of the editors at Wizards, just wrote her first Realms novel when it came out. And I love these things. I love their work, and I, you know, reach out to pounce on it. Susan Morris, who's my editor for my novels, has done some short stories, and I know when I see a short story set in the Realms by Susan, and there have been some in some of the collections, I just sit back and enjoy it because I know it's going to be good. Now, this is no different from seeing science fiction authors, heavyweights and lightweights everywhere. You know, there are certain authors that you know because they work for you as a reader. For me, Guy, Spider Robinson is another, Terry Pratchett is another, when he was still alive, Roger Zelazny was another. It didn't matter. I bought everything with their name on it. You know, I pre-ordered it. And when it came out, I knew I was going to enjoy it. Even if it was going to surprise mm-hmm. me, not be what I expected it to be, I knew I was going to enjoy it. Same thing. That, for me, those are the things that I'm particularly interested in the Realms now, because for increasingly, that's what the Realms is, the stories, the fiction. Sure. And, of course, that means when I write my novels, I have to be very careful of what I put in, mm-hmm. you know, and what stories I'm telling. And, of course, far more so than in the old days. There is now the editors are sort of there, alert, watching to see how the Realms is being presented in all of our books put together. So mm-hmm. if Bob Salvatore is writing this in this book, and Rich Baker is writing this in this book, okay, Ed, you're over here, good. You're not, the three of you aren't in each other's way. Okay, whereas
right.
when the Realms was first starting, and we were first doing novels, Doug Niles, Dark Heart, Walk on Moonshay, and those early ones, it was like, everybody in the pool, guys, we got to get tons of Forgotten Realms stuff out on the shelves as fast as we can. Write anything. Yes, yeah, cool. You know, so much so that I can remember Troy Denning coming to me in the TSR library and saying, okay, Ed, here's the map of the realm. Is there any place I can set a book that somebody else isn't camped in yet? You know, and literally, that was what we had to do. But things have changed now, so that to me, it's at the moment, it's got to be the fiction. Now, if Wizards of the Coast hears this interview and turns around and says, hey, Ed, we need you to write a huge game book just full of lore. Bring back Volo, and let's do Volo's Guide to the New Realms. And oh, yeah, we'll give you 10 volumes to do it in. Each of them will be 1,000 pages long. I would say, yes!
Right, yeah. And I'd scream yes with you.
I'm sure the fans would scream yes,
but I, yeah, I think they would. But I'm not getting the vibe that the company would be likely to do that at the moment. I think
right.
the direction... It, you know, we have lots more company-owned worlds, Dark Sun, Mystara, Dragonlance, mm-hmm. to bring back and give their spotlight in the sun. We've done two of them so far. We're moving into the third, and it looks like it's going to be one a year for a little bit,
mm-hmm.
And that's the thinking right now. And what that means is the Forgotten Realms isn't going to get the huge product line. None of them are. That they used to. I mean, it looks to me, from what I can tell from my secret ordering sheets, that it's the same way there was a Dragon Magazine annual, you know, a bound hardcover, there's going to be another one pulling on what was in DDI,
right.
you know. an annual or a compilation of stuff. I'm sure there's going to be another one. And there'll be, hopefully, some Forgotten Realms stuff in that. But, I mean, the thing is, it's mainly fiction now. So that's what I mainly look to.
I've always said that there should be a Forgotten Realms almanac that is released every year. You know, it's just a short little book to say, this is what's happened in the last year of the realms and some of the stories that have been told. Because there's a lot, like you talked about, there's a lot of people working in that world, and I can't possibly keep up with all of it. It'd be not cool if there was sort of a little abbreviated, this is what's going on, you know, and give you a chance to get just a little snippet of it every year.
Mm-hmm. Sure, I'd love to do that. Please buy the company.
Yeah, I'll get
it. Make them write it. but no, maybe some point in the future that will become the creative direction. But that idea has been floated.
Sure.
And it's been floated by people from the company asking people at Gen Con annually for the past 12 years that I can think of. And every year, of course, the audience at whatever venue they ask it at enthusiastically says yes. But of course, the audience is an audience of Forgotten Realms people got together for Forgotten Realms seminar.
Right.
And I imagine when they take that, hey, everybody at Gen Con wanted it, back to the office, they go, well, yeah, of course they wanted it. They were the Forgotten Realms people. But we got to decide from these few product slots that we can ship this year, what will sell the most copies. And, you know, there's this new cool thing that we want to do for another world or whatever, you know. So you can't do everything. I think every single one of the worlds that we know and love should get an almanac. But then again, don't ever let me run a company because I'm sure I could lose money faster than the White House. Let's put it that way.
Okay. But you'll have a lot of fun doing it.
Oh, yeah, I will have a lot of fun doing it. I think we should have an annual Boot Hill almanac. But then, how many copies would you sell? You know,
who still has Boot Hill?
But, you know, that's me. Yeah, the people who got killed and are buried up at Boot Hill this year are... but no, I would like to do one for all of the worlds.
Sure.
And I think that would be really cool. But then I'm, you know, like I said, that I don't see the sales figures. I have no idea what sells and what's popular.
You're,
other than what fans come.
Yeah. You mentioned that you're doing mostly story design now. You play primarily second edition. What kind of work are you doing in the fourth edition? I know you had a recent series of novels that finished that were not only pre-fourth edition, but from the Forgotten Realms in, you know, the second edition days in terms of the timeline.
That was the Knights of Mithranor series.
Yeah.
And that was my seizing my last chance to tell their story.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
Well, I have a new contract for multiple novels. The first one will come out this August, I think, at Gen Con, and it's called Elminster Must Die.
There you go.
Then there's a... Yes. And I'm not allowed to tell you the title of the second one yet. I haven't had clearance for it.
Okay.
But the second one, let me hint. It's another Elminster book, okay? It's a sequel to it.
So he didn't die?
I'm saying nothing. No. I will say the title does not lie. I do not deal in false advertising.
Okay.
Okay. However, you'll just have to read it to see how I weasel out of that one. But yes, there will be another Elminster book after that.
So,
the Avery Who Presents Waterdeep series looks like it's wrapping up. Okay. I am still writing a column, which appears in Dungeon Magazine online now. I wrote 12 columns ahead of time, and they have by no means even half of them have appeared so far. So, you know, that's still running. I do write articles occasionally as well for the online thing, and I write short stories for all of the anthologies that come out, and there will be a short story for the website for to go along with, to sort of herald the novel, okay? Mm-hmm. So I'm doing stuff like that, and I'm still sort of unofficially consulting with everybody.
Sure.
As they work on their Realms projects. And then, of course, I write stuff and design stuff outside Wizards of the Coast and outside the Forgotten Realms, both gaming stuff for Kobold Quarterly and Paizo and so on, and for my own fun with friends I've made in the gaming industry. And I write other novels, fantasy novels, for all sorts of other publishers because, let's face it, gaming writing pays, well, enough to cover your time.
Mm-hmm.
If you're good at writing novels and a publisher puts them out there, it occasionally pays enough to be a little bit extra, and you can live on it as long as you have a real life day job too. So I write more novels, and what I'm trying to do is have three series going with three publishers simultaneously, whenever possible, because that actually makes my bank account look healthy enough to buy groceries, and I like that. I'm a fan of buying groceries.
Sure.
So yeah, that's basically what I've been doing in the realms is at the moment primarily novels. And
the article,
sort of sitting in on story for others. Yeah.
And the new Elminster series is set in the post spell plague realms then?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I can tell you flat out that the first book is set in the year of the Ageless One, which is the baseline year zero.
Sure.
Or what for the fourth edition realm setting.
Now
you're gonna
have to take that back and completely redo that, because I've already used Elminster in my campaign in that year.
Yeah.
Well, that's okay. When you see what I did with him in the book, there's still room.
Oh, well, good.
See, the other thing is, I tend to write novels in which all of the action takes place in about 10 or 12 days at most, and it's usually 3 or 4 days in a row, just slam bam wham bam, and then there's we leave a day out, or two
sure.
days out, or 3 days out, and then slam wham wham slam time, and it's over. You know, so
sure.
there's plenty of other days in the year for him to do stuff.
Well, and
you see how I've left him. Oh,
yeah,
do anything with him now.
And I love the quote in the Forgotten Realms campaign setting from him about how, you know, he always he never quite believed there was anything in the world that was more powerful than him, and you know, despite having said otherwise, and found that he himself was surprised when the spell plague happened and discovered that that wasn't the case.
Oh yes, yeah. Well, okay. Elminster is not me. Okay.
Right.
And I had a lot of fun writing Elminster, but he shouldn't be seen as. He shouldn't be seen even as the equal of Gandalf, okay?
Mm-hmm.
He's not that... I like to equate Elminster with the way Nicol Williamson played Merlin in the movie Excalibur.
Mm-hmm.
There's a scene right. early in the movie at the siege where the knight says, "What, me surrender to a motherless boy? You're not even a knight." And he says, "You're right, I'm not." And he kneels in the muddy moat, hands him his sword, and says, "So knight me." And Merlin looks up and says, "I didn't see this." Okay, well, there's a lot. That's pretty close to Elminster.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Elminster sort of, "Oh, I didn't foresee this. Oops." You know, the thing about Elminster is when we see him on stage in most of the books, he's carrying a moment or a situation that he really shouldn't, in the same way the old saint character did in the saint, you know, by being glib of tongue and flippant when he was outnumbered and outgunned. And Elminster does a lot of that when we see him on stage. He's playing at being the sly old know-it-all, you know, and I'm in charge of everything here, and ho-ho-ho, wait till you see what's up my sleeve. Just to get people to manipulate them into doing what he wants them to do. You know,
right.
Most of it's flying by the seat of his pants. And, you know, frankly, if you really wanted to have a faithful servant and you were a goddess of magic, Elminster has only two things to recommend him. He's the slyest dog you can think of, and he always has an escape plan or six up his rear end, and therefore he might still be around when everybody else bites the dust. He would not be your preferred servant because he's totally disobedient, you know. In the same way, if you watch the TV series NCIS, the head of the team, Gibbs, would make a terrible director. And whenever he's been acting director, he's been a pain in the butt to everybody above him because he doesn't do anything by the book. He flies by the seat of his pants, you know. But he's too useful. And same with, say, in another TV series, the Doctor, House. He's a complete pain in the ass, but he's too useful to get rid of because he's actually effective.
Right.
Elminster's the same way. But no one should ever make the mistake of thinking that Elminster knows even half as much as he pretends to know. Okay? So, yeah, Elminster can easily be surprised, and he screws up all the time. And, in fact, if you read back over the published Elminster fiction that I've done since two decades of it, it's full of instance after instance of him screwing up.
Oh, yeah.
And which it always amuses me when gamers out on the net say, oh, yes, El Monster, you know, Ed Greenwood's Mary Sue, blah, 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 blah. And I think, really? You think I want to be a complete buffoon who screws up all the time? Okay. Do you actually read these Elminster things, or do you just sort of rail at them? You know? Because, you know, Elminster's career has been screwing up more often than not. Now, he's sly and cunning, and he gets away with a lot. He also gets away with finding good people and manipulating them into doing things, sometimes very much against their will, and sometimes just because Elminster has maneuvered them into a situation where the only thing that their nature will let them do is X, and that's what Elminster needs them to do. You know, be a good boy, just charge through that door and do X. I need you to do X. But, of course, he's not going to say that, because that would mean the person would dig in their heels. He says, oh, it would really be so disappointing and silly of you if you actually opened the door and did X. And they just glare at him, ram the door in there and do X. And he goes, good, that worked out rather well. You know, well, that's Elminster. You know, so he screws up all the time. And we're going to see more of that in the books ahead. And about which I'm not going to say anymore. A, because I haven't written most of them. And B, because my editrix will come up here and kill me.
We won't know.
I won't be able to write anymore. Yeah, it's so messy.
We don't want that.
All over this keyboard. Now, no, I don't. So I cannot say one word more about, well, yes, I can. But you just have to pry it out of me. So that's the thing. Elminster's just such a pain in the rear end most of the time. He won't do what you want him to do. You have to trick him into doing what you need him to do.
Well, I want to ask real quick, you sort of find yourself in an interesting position, being that you created the Forgotten Realms and you sort of grandfathered it in with, you know, not back in the late 80s, giving it to TSR, et cetera. And I've talked to other people about licensed products and whatnot, and you sort of had to come at it from a different angle. Of being the person that people have to come to say, is this okay? Does that still happen nowadays?
Okay. It was never, I mean, I was never a company employee, okay? So I never had any sort of veto power or approval rights over anything. But the people working on the realms, and the tone was set by Jeff and followed on Stephen Shand, Jim Lauder, Brian Thompson, that things worked a lot more easily if you consulted Ed. If you needed something in a hurry, like you needed a map of a city, or maybe just tell me about a city that's this size and has a port, and I needed to have pirates living in the port and not being thrown out by the lord of the city. Have you got anything like that? You know, it was a lot easier just to ask Ed. And Ed would send you something in a hurry. And, of course, from my point of view, that meant I got to sort of stick my finger in the pie and influence what got published, what got looked at in the realms, because I could say, oh, sure, I got this here. You got to look at this. This is really cool. You got to be here, sort of thing. And I could throw it at them. And so I got my say in things. I shouldn't have known anything about. But on the other hand, it was awfully handy for those people. So things do work better when products don't crash into other products because the right hand and the left hand don't know what each other is doing. Now, the current Wizards of the Coast, I get the feeling that they do consult very heavily with each other, you know, the books people, the gaming people, everything. So the people in the company know what's going on from one end of the company to the other about the realms or about whatever they're working on. You see what I mean? Mm-hmm. Whereas there are times in the past
right.
where you got the feeling somebody was doing a comic set in the realms here, somebody was doing a computer game set in the realms over there, and somebody was doing a line of novels here and another few novels over here and another game products over here, and none of those people might necessarily know what the other people were doing in detail, and that could be a problem. Now, I soon became a weak link in that, being as I wasn't on staff at the company, I was a freelancer, I didn't always know where anything was going on either. So coming to me to ask
right.
and say, hey, Ed, is this okay? I'd say, well, it's okay with me, but you better check with this guy, and this guy, because I don't know what they're doing, you know, because I don't work for the company. You got to ask them. But if it was a pure story thing, like, hey, Ed, where could we have a whole bunch of really powerful wizards who've been sleeping in their tombs for the last, 2,000 years? Where would be a good city to have them? Then I could say, well, what do you want to do with them? Do you need that city to be close to a kingdom or trade routes, or do you need it to be remote so people have to go on a big expedition to find it? You know, and they would answer that question. And I could say, okay, well, possibly this place, and this place. And nobody's done anything with this yet. But I have a feeling that this computer game company might be doing something with this over here. You better check with them before you use that. You know, and I could do that. So, you know, it's still fun to do that, but I don't do it on that level. I do it on the level down at Candlekeep, where it's, hey, can you give me a recipe for something that might be made in this kitchen that somebody could slip some poison into in my campaign, in this tavern, in this city, circa 1350 DR? And I could say, okay, sure, because I'm back in the past now, so I'm not mucking into anything the Wizards of the Coast is about to publish that I don't know about, because I'm back in the past, and I'm helping an individual Dungeon Master with their individual campaign. So if somebody needs to know a heraldic badge or the name of a particular noble family that it might be cool to have a traitor in, you know, I can give that. Whereas if it comes to the fourth edition realms, it's sort of like, well, hey, make up your own. You're free to do so now because we've jumped the century. It can be anybody you want.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the company doesn't, and the company, the designers working for the company and freelancers working with the company don't tell me if they don't need to or don't want to. So that means I'm not a bottleneck anymore, if I ever was. But individual Dungeon Masters, they're feel free to come to me, because I do the realms for the realm's sake and for all gamers' sake. It's fun for me, and it's probably going to be happening lifelong. So I'm used to it now. You know, people call me up and say, hey, Ed, my wife and I are about to have a baby daughter, and we'd like to pick a realm's name for her. Got me? And then I go, yeah. what color hair is she going to have, and what self-image do you want her to have? Because before I choose a name, I want to know that, if you want her to be a bad girl and a sorceress when she grows up or not. You know, you know what I mean? But I mean, I will always do that, but it doesn't have to happen in terms of new realms products anymore as much. But one of the things I love doing is getting together, particularly at Gen Con, and talking with any of the editors that are there, and any of the designers from the company that are there, and then all of the other freelance novelists, so we can talk about things. Wouldn't it be cool if we did this? Oh, why don't we set a story in that? Somebody should do a story about a vampire, you know, something like that. And we talk back and forth. And it doesn't matter who ends up getting to do it. We've had fun dancing around in our heads talking about the realms, and maybe something will come out of that. So I still get to do that, and that's great, cool fun.
Excellent. Well, to wrap up a little bit on, at least on the Forgotten Realms here, now other people get to play in your sandbox, as it were. Is there someone else's sandbox out there that you'd like to get a chance to play in?
Oh, there are tons of sandboxes I'd like to get a chance to play in. both fictional and game-wise. I'd like to do some more Pathfinder stuff. I love what Wolf is doing in Kobold Quarterly and his sort of steampunk setting. I'd love to do more of that. There are some other gaming companies that I'm working with right now, most of which I can't divulge any details
of.
And in the fictional world, yeah, there's lots of things I would like to get a chance to play in. There are a lot of fictional settings that I love, from Zelazny's Amber to George Martin's Westeros. There are tons of them. I read enthusiastically anything that J.V. Jones comes out with. And because I, for years, wrote a lot of books for Tor, some of the Tor editors still send me bound galleys of books that won't appear for a year for me to read and blurb for them, those little comments on the back covers and so on. And so I get to see some stuff that's about to come out. And there's I love worlds, created worlds of all sorts, whether they're meshed with our own, like the sort of Sherlock Holmes Gaslight London, or Lovecraftian, sort of with our real world, but the shadows that lurk behind what most of us see of our real world, and all of the mythos tales, to out and out fantasy settings of all sorts. I love all. There are some boxes I'd love to get to play in. The thing is, I start to get the feeling that I'm running out of time to get to leap into too many of them. It takes time to do a novel, and when you're doing or trying to do three novels a year, and they're taking a minimum of 3 months each just for the writing time, and then of course if you're doing rewrites, if you're doing publicity, if you're going back and forth with stuff, it inevitably takes up more time. Then you have less and less time to do other things. So, one of the things, job one for me, the first love will always be the Realms. So if I get a chance to do a Realms book, that's always going to be front burner. But I had great fun doing Falconfar books for Solaris. I've just done a trilogy. I did two Niflheim books with Tor before my editor there, Brian Thompson, and that passed away. Previous to that, I did five Aglerda books for Tor, and I love creating new worlds. I love working in other people's worlds, but it's more fun to create my own because I can make up my own rules. If you somebody else's sandbox, you have to learn so much about it. I remember some years ago there was talk of a particular publisher getting their hands on the Halo franchise, and I was approached. Hey Ed, you're a gamer, so you know all about Halo, right? No. Well, why not? Well, you see, because I'm a gamer, game designer. I don't have time to play computer games online or any other sort. Well, why not? Well, because when I sit down at a computer, I'm earning my living. I'm actually typing words that go into books. I don't have time to play computer games. You don't? Well, I play the occasional computer game. Here, I've got one right here. Castle Wolfenstein, it's called. It's got pictures. So the computer games before that were of the drop lantern, pick up dagger, pick up gold piece. You're carrying too much.
Yes.
Drop something so you can pick up gold piece. Oh, all right. and literally, I thought to myself, well, if I start doing Halo books, I'm going to have to start reading and become an expert in the Halo thing. You ask me to write a Star Trek book. I can probably write a half-decent Star Trek book, but to write a really good one, I have to do a lot of reading and research.
Mm-hmm.
It's more fun to just kick back and jump into the realms, because I know the realms.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of some of your other work and other publishers, is there any future that you know of for Castlemourne over at Margaret Weiss Productions?
I don't know. Margaret and I, the problem is by the time I get to talk to Margaret at Gen Con, she is so busy and I'm so busy, I don't think there's going to be any more Castlemourne products, like gaming products, from Margaret Weiss Productions? I don't think so, because I don't think it's sold well enough to justify a line of products. In comparison to some of the licenses that they were picking up at that time, Serenity and so on. I don't know. I have to talk to them. I would love to do a line of Castlemore novels. I would love to do more gaming stuff. I think it's a great open setting. Mm-hmm. It's just aching for you to pick up and use in your campaign, or stuff on the same planet, either the Forgotten Realms or any other fantasy setting of your choice, and just have it, oh, it's around the other side of the planet. You always wondered what was over there? Here it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I've got another one that I'm still working on that will probably take forever to come out, Embersea as well. But yeah, Castlemourne, I'd love to do more on. I had great fun with Jen Brozek. I had great fun with Peter Archer, who used to be head of the books department for Wizards of the Coast, was my editor on the first rule book. And then Brian stepped in, and Brian Goody, almost as a volunteer, and did lots of great design work, and I think he should be recognized for that, and I would love to do some more of the stuff with him, setting Castlemourne. That's one of those sort of settings that I sort of look up at on my shelf and go, yeah, got to get to that. Mm-hmm. Got to get to that real soon. And then another year rolls around, you know.
Yeah. And I know when I talked to the Margaret Weiss Productions guys, was it Jamie Chambers and Cam? I forget Cam's last name right now.
Cam Banks.
Banks. Yeah. Thank you. I talked to them about a year and a half ago at Origins at the same time that I talked to you, and there was sort of some talk at the time of Castlemourne maybe being a good fit for 4th edition and them sort of dipping their toe into 4th edition, but I haven't heard anything yet since that, so I thought maybe you knew something one way or the other on that, but apparently it doesn't look good.
I'm afraid I don't.
Okay.
No, I'm afraid I don't know anything. I mean, if it was up to me, but again, like I said before, caveat, you know, don't let me run a game company, okay? If it was up to me, I would be doing settings books that didn't have any stats in them at all.
Sure.
Okay? They would say, this guy's a really powerful wizard. This guy's a really powerful fighter, you know? And then you apply your edition of the game or your game system, whether it's Savage Worlds or GURPS or whatever, you use the one you want, and you just use the setting to be background setting material. Mm-hmm. I don't like the words crunch and fluff because, and to some extent, they convey wrong images of what the stuff that is involved. But, you know, if we use that terminology, I'd love to do all fluff books, unless I'm the publisher of a rule system, which, of course, I want to have crunch in the books. If I'm doing a setting book, I want it to be all fluff, and then it'll never date, except with things that happened in your campaign, but it won't date from the point of view of a rule system. You know, to me, that's the one tragedy of the realms over the years. If we remember back in the day, the assassins were being taken out of the game, so all of a sudden in the realms, all the assassins dropped dead. You know, you're going, wait a minute. You know what I mean? It's very uncomfortable when things have to change. Without an explanation, without an in-game explanation for a change in something that happened in the rules, and whether it's large or small. And that's the one thing I would love to do stuff with no stats in it. Now, I don't know if gamers would love to buy them. That's why I, you know, sure, I keep attaching that caveat. But to me, it was like, let me do a pure story book, the setting and the story, because then the people who don't need setting and story can look at it in the hobby shop and say, oh yeah, here's Ed doing one of the storybooks, but I don't need it. Put it back on the shelf. And a dungeon master who doesn't have time to generate the background stuff, or who loves the background stuff I happen to do, or anybody else happens to do, could say, oh good, this is what I've been waiting for. I can pick it up and use it, but he won't contradict any of my game stuff that I'm doing in my campaign. You know, to me that would be the perfect thing. And then therefore, you know, for instance, if Margaret Weiss Productions had done a totally game system neutral Castlemourne, it wouldn't matter if we were 4th edition,
sure,
or 3rd, or mm-hmm, something else. You know, it could be, you just use it. But anyway, that's probably a complete other can of worms that gaming gaming aficionados will come down on various sides of, depending on their own needs.
Well, excellent. I just have one last question to ask you. Are you currently playing or running anything right now? And if not, what was the last thing you had a chance to? When was the last time you had a chance to roll some dice?
Ooh, okay. I'm not running anything right at the moment. This month, the last time I had a chance to roll dice was playing a playtest of something I'm not allowed to tell you about. Mm-hmm. And the last time before that, but don't worry, it's nothing thrilling, you know. It's just, but you know, NDAs had signed. And the last time before that was when my granddaughter was visiting, and we play all sorts of stuff, chess and Scrabble. And
nice.
I always let her sort of wander through the dungeon where I keep all my gaming stuff. And of course, inevitably, the cool boxes with cool things on them catch the eye. And so we drag something out to play it. And sometimes it's something I've never actually played. And sometimes it's an old favorite. And we have great fun playing a lot of the cheap-ass games, you know, the short, simple, fun, quirky games. Lord of the Fries get fun. And I think the last time I rolled dice, aside from the playtest, was that. Before that, the last one would have been a Forgotten Realms scenario that I ran for a few friends at a convention. We just roll played.
Nice.
And when I say rolling dice, I think I rolled dice twice in 5 hours. It was all role playing.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, when they're working their way through an urban situation, asking things, you know, their characters are asking things of non-player characters. That's what all the play was, you know, trying to find out stuff.
Right.
And dealing with comical NPCs, you know, because you're in an urban situation, and, you know, I, as Dungeon Master, can always pull up one of these man mountains of flesh who says, I hope you're... You don't like that sort too much. It'd be a pity if something happened to that sort. You know. So there's 3 or 4 hours of dealing with that rather than rolling dice, because they sort of look up at the man mountain, and he smiles at them, you know, revealing one fang, looking with his lower lip and says, "Oh, the way. Did I forget to tell you? I cast spells, lots of spells." You know, and they go, oops, is he bluffing, or should we just keep our trousers dry, you know?
Well, I guess I was lying. I do have one last question, actually, beyond that one.
Fire away. I'm okay.
Gaming is, part of our show is we talk about how basically great the gaming hobby is. That's why we're the Gamer's Haven, and, I'm curious as to your thoughts on to what makes gaming just such a really just a wonderful hobby for you.
For me personally, it's the great friends
yes.
I've made. It is people I only see once a year at a convention who I can pick up with, like we just sort of parted last year, you know. Except that a year's worth of fun stuff for them to tell me about has happened since I saw them last, you know. But it's
sure.
getting together with friends to laugh and chat. I mean, that's the good bit. The wider bit, the thing that makes gaming so nice, and it's the same thing with writing science fiction and fantasy, because it's the same basic underlying thing. These friends I get together with at gaming are the most intelligent and creative people in the world. They might occasionally feud and fight viciously because they are people of strong egos and strong opinions and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But they are not the dullards. They are not the pencil pushers. They're not the follow the rule book types. So as much as they are the creative people, the people with fire, the people who can imagine things, the people who are sensitive to others, whether they choose to put that first or not is another thing. But I mean, these are the people who you think could save the world if they put their heads together. These are the people who can create new and exciting things, or take something as old and as familiar as macaroni and cheese and dress it up in a new way so that I'm excited about it again. I mean, there are some games that are as old as the hills in terms of their subject matter, but somebody puts a new wrinkle on them, you know, and I go, oh, wow, I want to play that. That's cool. and you know, to me, it's having those great friends and having the group of people who play the hobby being the sort of people where you just smile and you say, yes, isn't this cool? And, you know, I've been to Gen Cons where instead of one or two stormtroopers in full armor guarding the door to the exhibit hall, you can see 30 of them marching in unison. You know, that's an impressive sight. Or little kids, you see them walking around looking up at people dressed as Batman or dressed as Spider-Man or, you know, dressed as a warrior of Gondor and say, wow, this is it's real. And to me, that's sort of really, really cool. You know, and we've all heard about or done or seen, and so probably have our grandparents, about putting cards together in little castles and piling them up. But at Gen Con, and we can find the photographs to prove it if we didn't, you know, if we're trying to talk to other people who didn't go about, you know, what was there, you can find a whole hallway full of skyscrapers of cards folded and put on their sides. It's like, wow!
Yep.
and you can play Starfleet Battle in a room that's so big that you know the Klingons are at the other end of the room because you can see the guys playing them standing there. But you can't see where their ships are because the ships are so small and the carpet in the room is so vast that it really is realistic. It's like Space Battle. The Klingons are over there somewhere, but we don't know exactly where. Whereas, you know, if you're playing it on your kitchen table at home, yeah, you can see the Klingons. Their miniatures are set up right over there. And it's really cool. But to me, the best part of gaming is getting together with friends. It used to be playing the games, but I'm not a competitive guy, so I don't really care if I win or lose or if anything happens during a play session. It's a chance to be sitting around a table with people you like and doing something together, energetic. You know, and you know, it doesn't matter if I win. I don't care. You know, I'm not one of those guys who has to win the tournament or has to you know, my character has to get the most treasure. I could care less. I just want to have a good time.
Excellent. Well, I, for one, definitely want to thank you for taking the time out to talk to us tonight. It was a fabulous discussion, I think.
It's great. It's great fun. I like to hang out and talk gaming.
Cool. Hopefully, when the new Elminster book comes out, we can get together and chat about that in some more detail.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, sure. I have to warn you, Elminster Must Die comes out in August, and then there's a book called Elminster Ascending that comes out later in the year. It's just the first three Elminster novels put together. You know, the annotated Elminster that we had before went out of print. So if you see this Elminster Ascending, it's not another new novel. It's the first three again.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool.
Great.
All right. Yeah, let's get together and talk.
Will do.
Cool.
Excellent.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, see ya.
Subscribe to the show by visiting our website at gamershavenpodcast.com, where you can also discuss all things gaming in our forum, drop us an email, or just peruse our episode archives. You can also call us toll-free and leave a message to be played on the show by dialing 1-877-416-1270. That's toll-free, 877-416-1270.
On our website, you'll also find our actual play podcasts chronicling our misadventures through all things role-playing. Enjoy what you hear? Why not support the Gamers Haven by purchasing Gamers Haven merchandise, visiting our affiliates, or just by clicking on our donate button? The Gamers Haven podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial, Share Alike 3.0 United States license, some rights reserved. Some music in this podcast is used with permission of Joe Hero Band at joehero.com. This is a Thousand Monkeys production.
This concludes the broadcast from World Control.